From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. And here are the issues. Turkey sent troops into Syria for the first time since the start of that country's civil war, seeking to clear out ISIS from its last town on the border with Turkey and prevent Syrian Kurds from expanding their territory. One of the world's longest guerrilla wars came to an official end with the signing of a peace accord between the Colombian government and the rebels known as the FARC. Hillary Clinton met with more than 80 donors to the Clinton Foundation when she was Secretary of State. Clinton says there was no conflict of interest, but Bill Clinton promised to end foreign and corporate donations to the foundation if his wife is elected president. Finally, Clinton's Republican rival, Donald Trump, made a pitch to African-American voters, called Clinton a bigot, and softened his often repeated plan to deport 11 million illegal aliens. Clinton denounced Trump as a racist in bed with something called the alt-right. Well, David, let's start with the international news, and let's start with Turkey. The United States has been begging the Turks for years to get more actively involved in the Syrian conflict directly, to do something about ISIS, which, of course, has mounted a number of attacks in Turkey recently. Finally, the Turks sent in troops and tanks. Why?
Well, you can see the frustration is obvious on the American side, not just because Turks are nominally close allies, members of NATO, also have a gigantic army, the largest army other than the Americans in NATO. And also, the Islamic State had territory right on the Turkish border. You could see Islamic State strongholds from Turkey. And on several occasions, the Turks have just stood and watched as the Islamic State battled rebels. What seems to trigger this is not really a massive change of position on the Islamic State so much as the long-standing concerns that the Turkish government has about the Kurds. Kurds in Syria, Kurds in Turkey. So Kurds in Syria becoming too strong immediately makes them panic about Kurds in Turkey becoming too strong. So I guess the short version would be that because the Kurds seem to be making some real headway in terms of taking territory off the Islamic State near the Turkish border, the Turkish government of Recep Tayyip Erdogan decided if anyone was going to hold that territory, it was right. going to be his forces right. and not the Kurds.
Right. Michael, the Kurds, as David pointed out, have done very, very well in this war. The trigger seems to have been their successful operation in a place called Manbij, where the U.S. supported them with air support and so on, but the Kurds went in and they did something really important. They crossed the Euphrates
right.
River into Manbij to clear it from ISIS rebels. They've made a pledge now about Manbij and about the Euphrates. What was that pledge?
Well, the pledge is that, and this was somewhat, I think, brokered during the recent visit by Vice President Biden to visit Turkey, that the position of the Kurds will be across the Euphrates.
On the other side.
On the other side of the Euphrates. And this was a conditional. It had to be for the United States and Turkey to approve this whole mission. It's sort of like that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, you know, type of thing here. It was a situation where the United States and Turkey were involved in some tensions because of the attempted coup a few weeks ago.
Right, against Erdogan.
Right, and there needed to be something that sort of reestablished the ability of the United States and Turkey to work together in a situation. So here's a case where the United States had established a need for some ground troops in this fight against ISIS.
Right.
And Turkey had this interest, as David pointed out, in clearing out the Kurds from their borders. So it's a common interest, and it appears to have worked out very, very well. And it just changes the whole dynamic now mm-hmm. that you have, as you say, this huge dynamic military power in Turkey willing to cross borders and be on the ground involved in this conflict in the former country of Syria. And it just also establishes more and more that there really is no country there anymore. It's just sort of a place where people are fighting for their own interests.
Yeah. David, one of the things the Turks have been calling for years is a safe haven or a no-fly zone on the border. Could this be the beginning of the creation of that zone? I mean, the U.S. has always said, fine, but who's going to police the place? You know, we can monitor it from the air, but who will provide the troops on the ground? Do you think that could be the beginning of it? We know that Hillary Clinton has spoken favorably of creating a zone like that in northern Syria.
I guess in the sort of multi-dimensional chess game that is the kind of the horror of Syria, if this development had happened maybe 2 years ago, 18 months ago, you could say, yeah, this does simplify things a little. Maybe you could start to get a no-fly zone. But I was very struck. I was at a briefing yesterday by someone who is until recently high up in the National Security Council dealing with this stuff, who said even if Hillary Clinton wins the next election, and even given her position in favor of things like a no-fly zone, since she first said those things 18 months ago, 2 years ago, you know, there have been gigantic complicating developments. Most notably, there are now Russian planes all over the sky. You would then have to have the most extremely kind of close, careful coordination between all of the different militaries, the American military, the Turkish, NATO, the Russians, to an extent that really does not seem possible at the moment, given the politics between all of these various players. I think there's also a note of caution before we get too optimistic about the Kurds taking territory. I think sitting in Washington, there's a kind of lazy thing that, say, senators who know a little bit of foreign policy say, which is, oh, we have allies there. Our boots on the ground are Kurdish boots on the ground. We just need to give the Kurds lots of guns. They like Americans. They'll take care of this. And then we've got Muslims on the ground and they can do the fighting for us. Again, a point made in this briefing yesterday, which is very striking, is even if things go amazingly well in the fight against Islamic State and say, you know, they lose Raqqa, the city of Raqqa, and suddenly that needs to be held and occupied, Kurdish troops cannot occupy Raqqa for any length of time because that's an Arab town. And so there is a desperate problem that our best friends on the ground are just the wrong ethnicity to be our allies, you know, in any durable sense. We still are back at the problem needing moderate Sunni allies, and that's the real problem.
Yeah, I'll let me quote from the State Department spokesman on that very point. She said, we do have commitments from Kurdish leadership that those forces who stabilize the area will mirror the local populations. We believe that's the best solution for a long-term, sustainable peace. The local population stays and rebuilds that area and restores local control. And that's a very direct comment, basically saying that Arabs should be in control of Arab areas and not Kurds. I think we'll leave Turkey and we'll go to another conflict that has, it appears, a happy ending, Michael, and that is the situation with Colombia. As long as I can remember, I mean, my life, I think, there have been rebels called the FARC that have been fighting the central government in Colombia. And now, all of a sudden, we have an actual peace accord that has been accepted by the leadership of both Colombia and these rebels. It has to go to a referendum. It has to be approved. But it's a remarkable development.
It has. And it's taking a long, long time. And as you say, this is the longest running, and I guess it's the last guerrilla, old-fashioned guerrilla battle that's being fought in the Americas. 52 years, something like that. I mean, hundreds of thousands of lives lost, millions displaced by this conflict. It's kept Colombia from being an actual entire state because how can you have a government when it doesn't control its own land? And you've had rebels controlling this land for so long. It is, though, a great, great step forward that you have a ceasefire and you have some sort of framework for a peace agreement. Now you have the situation of how do you make it stick? How do you keep these people who were former rebels, how do you assimilate them into the territories? How do you get them to drop multi-million, maybe $1 billion cocaine industry that they've used to finance their operations? The challenges are great. And there's a political challenge because the former president, Uribe, is actually against this. He thinks that this is not justice that's being brought to. It's just kowtowing and capitulating to the rebels. So there are hurdles, but it's really, really good to see a ceasefire and some sort of, again, a framework for moving forward.
Yeah. David, the provisions of this agreement are rather elaborate. The rebels have to come out of the jungle in their hideouts, move to 23 relocation zones and 8 existing rebel camps. There's aid to demobilize guerrillas. There's a truth commission that will grant amnesty to rebels and government soldiers. The FARC is also going to be given 5 seats in the Senate and in the House of Representatives for the next 2 sessions of Congress. It reminds me, in a way, of the Northern Ireland agreement, doesn't it?
There's hints of the South African model of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Right.
If you don't think that you're going to get these people into a criminal court, then you have this idea of restorative justice, the idea that if the families of those people who are their victims are able to see them sort of admit what they did and express contrition, that's the next best thing to criminal justice path. So there's some extraordinarily complex details. So as you say, as Michael says correctly, the referendum on October the 2nd is not a done deal. President Alvaro Uribe, the former president, who did also do a lot to try and bring peace to Colombia and to tackle the drug problem, he's in many ways a reasonably admirable man. He's campaigning hard for a no vote. The American government does not know what will happen if the Colombians vote no. They don't have a plan B. You know, these peace talks have been going on in Cuba, brokered by the Cubans and the Norwegians. The Americans have been very supportive. President Obama has been very supportive. But we don't know what happens if they vote no. And some of it is really complicated. So as you say, they're basically being asked to come out of the jungle and to turn themselves immediately into a kind of far-left political party. They've been given these automatic seats. They don't have to get elected for the first few years, 5 seats in both in each chamber. But remember, they tried that before. And when they tried becoming a political party before, they were some of their members were gunned down by right-wing death squads. So one of the deals in this is that the Colombian government has had to give security guarantees to people who come out of the jungle and try and become politicians. And you do have families, as Michael says, hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. There are a lot of families who think of these people as unpunished, unrepentant murderers. And so I think the game clearly is taking, as you say, the model of the South African, somewhat Northern Ireland, is to say, okay, well, they will be repentant, but maybe they will remain unpunished. Maybe we'll have to put up with them as politicians as long as they're repentant. That's the gamble they're taking.
Yeah. Still, this should enable Colombia's economy really to finally take off if the peace holds. Yeah, Michael?
Yeah, so it's certainly very difficult to have a functioning economy when, again, you don't have control of transportation, large portions of the wealth and the resources of your country. So, yes, it should enable a resurgence in Colombian prosperity, let's say. But, you know, as an American, I know something about the difficulties of healing the wounds of a civil war. We're still well into that, as we'll probably talk about later, I think. And I think David from his country knows a little bit about the unpredictability of referendums. So,
Indeed. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin, I'll Monitor and the Atlantic Council. And joining me today are Michael Williams of CBS Radio and David Rennie of The Economist. This is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/archive/issues-in-the-news. We're going to turn to domestic politics, which in some ways, David, has been as violent as what we've seen overseas, at least in rhetorical terms. I don't think I've ever seen a campaign that has disintegrated into these kinds of charges of corruption, of racism. It's really been quite extraordinary. With Hillary Clinton, of course, we've had new revelations. The Associated Press did an investigation of those she met with in the first 2 years that she served as Secretary of State. And apparently of 154 non-governmental types that she met with, 85 were donors to the Clinton Foundation. There is no evidence, as far as we know, of overt corruption, of pay-for-play, but the appearance, once again, is, how should we put it, a little bit unseemly.
So if I were the Clinton campaign spokesman, I would say that the Associated Press story was, you know, outrageous, and that many of the people that she met, who they called sort of donors to the Clinton Foundation, also just happened to be kind of Nobel Prize winners, who had every reason to be visiting an American Secretary of State. I think fundamentally, there's two big problems going on. One is, as you say, basically there's a Clinton problem, that we've been here before. You know, there's, you know, how many times have we had a problem where their opponents say they have absolutely clearly broken the law, and their defenders say, no, they absolutely haven't broken the law because of this technicality and this sort of little minor detail here. And then everyone else thinking, well, maybe they bent the spirit of the law, even if they obeyed the letter of the law. So it's a kind of an exhausting process with the Clintons. I think there's something else going on here, which may be a little bit more forgivable, which is that Hillary Clinton is trying something that has never been done before. What's she trying is Bill Clinton left the American presidency and went through the money door. He went through the money door where suddenly you're trying to raise money for yourself, for your family, for your charity, for your foundation, and you lose the constraints of being a politician, and you can suddenly start, you know, palling around with very rich people, foreign governments, and the rules get looser. Hillary Clinton joined him at a certain point in going through that money door because she wasn't in public office after she left the Senate. The problem is, she then came back through the money door to become Secretary of State. Then she goes back out again and becomes a Clinton Foundation person, palling around with donors, foreign governments. Then she decides to run for the president, and she's trying her next run through that one-way money door. Sure. And I think that's a problem, because Bill Clinton If it was just him, we'd understand it. You know, you are a president, then you're no longer a president. You're a private citizen. You go through the money door, yeah. and you can pal around with donors and hang around on their corporate jets and collect money a bit for yourself and a bit for good causes, and everyone's happy. It's the fact that that money door looks more kind of one way than the Clintons are willing to accept yeah. that I think is the fundamental problem here.
More like a swinging door, actually, Michael. Yeah. But, I mean, it should be pointed out that George H.W. Bush apparently established a foundation after he left office, and that foundation continued in business while his son was president. Now we have all these calls for Bill Clinton. He said he would step away. There are indications that Chelsea Clinton would probably step away as well if her mother is elected president. They're going to turn over many of their programs to other charities to manage, even though the charity itself has done a lot of good work.
The charity itself has done a lot of good work. I think, well, there is some argument about that. You can argue about anything, you know, in this political climate.
But sure, but AIDS, medicine, that kind of thing, right?
Absolutely. But to stand behind the good work that the foundation has done as a blind to the ethical challenge that this portrays, it's like self-delusional, you know.
Yeah.
The Clintons are so fascinating as people because they, throughout their political life, have proven themselves to be the people who like to rub against the fence of the law and what's real and what's right and what's legal and that sort of thing and say, we're on the right side of the fence, trust us, when mm-hmm. they are the people who people trust the absolute least. So why would you not be in the center of the field? Why take those meetings at all? Sure. Why is Huma Abedin making those meetings and making those calls? If you're really concerned about what the average person thinks, other than in an election year, you just don't do it. But it yeah. seems like it becomes a concern when somebody finds out about it. And then we'll take these steps and we'll make these changes. What was wrong now was wrong then. Look, we had a governor who almost went to jail arranging a meeting over amounts of money that had several less zeros than this.
Yeah, Virginia governor. Yeah. And Huma Abedin, of course, is Hillary Clinton's longtime chief assistant, yeah. as we know.
I think what's fascinating is the accusation from their opponents is that this was influence peddling, that you could give money and you could
pay to play.
You gave money and then Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, made things happen for your company. What's interesting about some of the revelations is what they really seem to have been doing is access for cash. It was pay for access. But actually, you have a case of a wealthy donor who wanted a visa for a footballer who is one of his sports sort of athletes in a team of his, didn't get the visa.
Sure.
So actually, the influence,
didn't get the meeting.
Yeah, the influence peddling you didn't get, but what you did get, you got to exchange emails with very powerful gatekeepers in that very, very tight inner circle around Hillary Clinton. And I think fundamentally, there is a problem with the fact that some of the people closest to Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State had these double jobs. They were once sort of contracted to the State Department as senior assistants to Hillary Clinton. They were also working for essentially a commercial consultancy, the Tenure right. Group. You know, that really does kind of whiff a bit. Mm-hmm. And once again, I mean, how many times have we said it in this crazy election cycle? If she had a normal Republican opponent, yeah. this stuff would be killing her.
Yeah, exactly. Hillary Clinton is the luckiest Democratic candidate in my memory in that sense. Right?
Oh, absolutely. Because you have two candidates out there committing, you know, simultaneous suicide, I mean, with one gaffe after the other. Look, I think that the Clintons at some point need to decide what they want to be when they grow up. You know, if you want to be a politician, you want to be a person of the people and that sort of thing, do that. If you want to be a player on a global scale, you know, doing diplomacy at 30,000 feet, do that. But we have now proof that this is a very, very difficult thing to do. Yeah. It's just difficult.
But as you point out, she's very lucky in her opponent. And when Donald Trump called Hillary Clinton a bigot at a rally a few days ago, you even saw somebody captured the look of a woman behind him on the videotape. Her jaw dropped of all the people to accuse of being a bigot. Yeah. Is this mirror imaging? Is this psychological projection? What do you make of Trump's sort of ninth inning appeal to African Americans and even to people who have been upset by his immigration policies?
If it wasn't so, it's almost laughable. You know, it's almost the idea, both of Hillary Clinton as a bigot, to use that term, that's a horrible term to use on the pulpit. I'm really upset and shocked and ashamed that we've reached that level in our political discourse. That's the first thing. I will say that Donald Trump has almost completely gone over to this whole alt-right.
You need to explain what the alt-right is.
The alt-right is a loosely defined group of websites and people and organizations who have taken terms like white supremacy and turned into white nationalist, who've turned racism into racialist. They're trying to justify and really put into the mainstream the ideas behind a certain type of white supremacy. And this has been held in sort of abeyance in the Republican Party for some years. It's, you know, sort of occupied this dark corner. Now Trump has given them a seat at the table, and I mean a favored seat at the table.
Yeah, his campaign chief.
the people who are leading his campaign, I think, are some of the most objectionable people in American politics or politics all over the world. And the fact that he would do that, to me, just sort of states who that guy is at his core.
Sure.
He doesn't care how he wins. He just wants to win. And that's a problem for me. I do not like to see either candidate calling each other a bigot. But if anyone deserves to have that attached to him, I think it would be Trump rather than Clinton.
David, the alt-right has connections also to movements in Europe that are populist, nationalist, white supremacist. And Donald Trump had an interesting companion at this rally where he called Hillary Clinton a bigot. I believe Nigel Farage was with him.
That's right. So he's very excited, Donald Trump, by the parallels between the referendum in Britain earlier this summer, where, to the surprise of the opinion pollsters and to the surprise of a lot of pundits, although I should say not to The Economist or to me, we did think it was very dangerous, that the British decided to vote to leave the European Union. You can see other parallels. Why would Donald Trump be excited? Why would he invite Nigel Farage, as you say, was one of the leaders of this campaign? Well, for one thing, he wants to say, I may be behind in the opinion polls, but that doesn't mean anything, because look what happened in the UK. They were behind in the opinion polls,
and they won.
So the experts don't know anything. The kind of pointy-head, big city, kind of, you know, thumb-sucking columnists don't understand. They're, you know, the proper, decent, ordinary, yeoman, stalwart voters out there in the country who are leading this wholesome rebellion against globalism in favor of, you know, looking after your own first.
America first.
Exactly. So America first, look after your own first, Britain first. You know, there is a pattern there. I think what he's also trying to do, and I think this is important, when Donald Trump has been trying to soften some of his rhetoric recently on immigration, when he's been also sort of trying to pitch himself as the best friend the African-American, you know, public
well,
has.
What do you have to lose, I think?
Yeah, what do you have to lose and you should vote for me? And this idea that the Democrats are the worst racists, which comes straight from conservative talk radio. It's not him that invented this. This idea that Democrats take, you know, black voters for granted and don't do anything for them is a staple of conservative talk radio. What he's really trying to do, I don't think he actually thinks he's going to win many black votes. I mean, he's currently on 1% in some polls, so that's a pretty deep hole to dig yourself out of. What he's actually trying to do is the really important thing that's happened to him that must frighten him a lot is he is hemorrhaging support among educated white voters, particularly educated white women voters. White voters with a college degree have backed the Republican presidential candidates at every presidential election since 1952. Donald Trump is losing them by double-digit margins at the moment. He's losing college graduate women by 30 percentage points. They went for Mitt Romney by 6 points last time in 2012.
Yeah.
So he's managed to basically just alienate a vital part of his network. Who are these people? They're educated. They're much less interested in voting for someone who they think is a racist. So he is trying to give them permission to vote for him. He's trying to shed the label of being someone who's of the dirty right, who can't be voted for if you're an educated person. That's what's going on.
Yeah. But Michael, when it comes to immigration, of course, Trump burst on the scene by calling Mexicans rapists and criminals and vowing to build a wall to block immigration. But in the last few days, he's been all over the map on immigration. Do we have any idea what his policy would be? The last enunciation I heard of it sounded like something Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio would have put forward.
Well, you know, if you're talking about, do we know what his policy is going to land on? Well, of course, it's spin that wheel. You know, he's been all over the map on every single issue. Again, this is the result of people coming in and telling him to soften his position because he needs to, as David pointed out, to make himself a little more palatable to people who he absolutely needs to win that election. Aim high. You know, right thing to do. Look, he is picking up the old reliable saws of conservative talk radio and is relying on the non-traditional voter to win this thing for him.
Okay. Well, on that note, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. This program was produced by Anya Zaleski. Our engineers were Wagner Roberts and Linus Rimkus. I'm Barbara Slavin, acting director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.